The following podcast is a presentation of the Washington College of Law at American University. Any unauthorized use or distribution is strictly prohibited.
Because we only have an hour today, feel free to get your food, but we are going to go ahead and get started. There's a limited window. Sorry we are in a room without windows. Speaking of windows, we organized this a little bit last minute, so glad to see you all here. As most of you know, my name is Susanna Sakwoku, and I direct the War Crimes Research Office here at the law school. We have a war crimes speaker series that we hold throughout the academic year, and we've had people from every side that we work with come speak to you, to the WCL community and beyond, about issues in international criminal law and international humanitarian law that are at the forefront of this field. Today, we're extremely lucky to have with us an old colleague of mine, actually, Binai Funyoroji, who is at OSI in Kenya, split between Kenya and New York. And we're going to hear from two guests today about fighting for accountability in Kenya, and in particular, the ICC involvement in Kenya. I'm going to turn it over to Binai first so that she can introduce to you our speakers, and then we'll get started. Thank you.
Great. Good. My name is Binai Funyoroji, and I head the Open Society Initiative for Eastern Africa based in the Nairobi office. So we're a grant-giving and an advocacy organization that works on human rights and governance issues. So the issue of transitional justice has been very much part and parcel of our work. Just a quick read. How many of you are familiar with Kenya in terms of the details? Okay. So what I'll do for those of you who are not, I'll give just a quick briefing on the events that have brought us to where we're at, and then I'll introduce our two speakers, and they'll speak in more detail about the specifics of the transitional justice mechanisms and where things are at in Kenya. But essentially, Kenya was a country that really didn't have any intersection on the international justice front at all in terms of issues. We'd had a number of bouts of essentially politically motivated ethnic violence preceding a number of elections as we went forward in a multi-party system. But essentially, it didn't reach the level that it did in the last election. So in 2007, Kenya had its presidential and parliamentary elections that took place in a setting where essentially the democratic process had actually moved forward quite significantly from over two decades of dictatorship to a much more kind of thriving democratic system. And we went we basically moved from dictatorship to a new government that came in headed by President Kibaki in 2002 that basically came in on a human rights platform. They said, you know, we were in the opposition, we are for good governance, we are for human rights, we are the new government. And a number of people from the human rights movement moved from the civil society movement into government. And for the first year or so, there was just a great sense of exhilaration that things were going right in Kenya after a very long time, and that things were really moving on the right track. It was shortly in the first term of the Kibaki administration, that it became clear that actually there was a lot of backsliding going on. The cabinet became captured by a group of ethnic hardliners from the Kikuyu ethnic group, which is Kibaki's ethnic group, that began to push a very strong ethnic sort of line in terms of trying to promote Kikuyu interests, and not just Kikuyu interests for the entire community, but for Kikuyu elite interests. And that the corruption networks that really Kenya had been plagued by were reinforced, and this group began to enrich itself. The anti-corruption czar that was put into place, John Githongo, was threatened for his life and fled, and the anti-corruption movement, which had made significant strides, was essentially destroyed in the early days. All this to begin to amass funds for the next election in 2007. The election took place, and it was by and large a free and fair election in 2007. People came out in huge numbers to the polls, and essentially what looked like the results started coming in on day one and day two, and it looked like the opposition candidate Raila Odinga was in the lead for the first 2 days. On the third day, on the day two as it ended, Raila was winning by about 1 million votes. Day three, at the end of day two, basically the government came in and started, they started to announce more results that were coming in, and the opposition began to protest that these results were not the correct ones. The Electoral Commission agreed that they would go back to the drawing board, check things, and come back. The third day they came back, they started reading the same results. Essentially, there was a big protest by the opposition. The electricity went out in the Kenyatta International Conference Center where the vote counting was happening. And essentially, the next thing Kenyans saw on their TV was that the Electoral Commission head was announcing that President Kibaki had won the election by 500,000 votes. Within 24 minutes of that announcement, the president was being sworn in at State House in a very hurried and kind of furtive inauguration ceremony that contrasted very dramatically with his 2003 swearing in, where he had been in the Uhuru Park with 20,000 people coming to essentially see the swearing in. This and essentially then a ban on live political broadcasting was placed by the new Kibaki government, and there was sort of a silence. Kenyans were outraged. They really felt that the process had been stolen from them. And in the home area of Raila Odinga, violence immediately broke out. Protests, demonstrations, actually unarmed demonstrations, came out to protest this, which were met with significant security force. People were basically gunned down. They sent the security forces into Nyanza province, where there was a significant show of force. Retaliatory violence then began to organize amongst the Kalenjin community, which had been part of Raila Odinga's political coalition against Kikuyus, who were living in the Rift Valley province, against the ethnic group of Kibaki. And the violence continued to spread over the next few months, resulting in ultimately the displacement of some 300,000 and the deaths of over 1,000 people. The violence was eventually stopped through a negotiated mediation that was led by Kofi Annan, the former UN Secretary General, under the auspices of the African Union. This mediation accord basically is governing Kenya and resulted in a coalition government in which Raila Odinga and his party were brought into a coalition agreement where he is now the prime minister, and there's a shared power sharing. And there are a number of specific tasks within the mediation accord that Kenya is moving towards, one of which is criminal accountability for those responsible for the violence. And this is where my colleagues will speak into more detail. But essentially, one of the first commissions that was set up was a commission to look into the post-election violence. It was called the Waki Commission. George was the secretary of that commission, that basically documented the violence that had taken place and put out a report that suggested that those most responsible for the violence should be held accountable through a domestic mechanism. In the event that they weren't, the evidence collected by the Waki Commission would be essentially handed over to Annan, who would hand it to the International Criminal Court, which is led to where we are at today. But essentially, at this moment in time, we're at the two-year mark of essentially what's going to be a five-year transition period to take us to the 2012 elections. The transitional justice processes it's been quite an interesting road to walk down, but it's included the International Criminal Court, it's included discussions around a special tribunal that would be formed domestically, and it's included the issue of a Truth and Reconciliation Commission, all of which my colleagues will speak to a little more to tell you where things are at. But it's been an interesting road, and to date, in true Kenyan style, impunity continues to reign. Nobody has actually been punished for the violence, although we are, you know, midway through the process. So George Kigoro is the head of International Commission of Jurists, the Kenya branch, and as I mentioned before, was the secretary of the Waki Commission that looked into the post-election violence. And Sam Muhochi used to head a group called IMLU, the Independent Medical Legal Unit, that works around medical and legal assistance and forensic evidence gathering, and did very important work in the post-election violence, documenting the types of violence that took place, and is now currently working with a coalition looking at the defense of human rights defenders. So let's open the floor. I think we'll start with Sam. And I think we're at quarter past. I think if each of you can speak no more than 10 to 15 minutes, and then we'll open the floor to questions. Does that sound good? Okay, and I will get myself some lunch now that I'm off of it.
Okay, thank you. Good morning, everybody. Now, one thing Binaifa did not mention is that Kenya was a single party state until 1992, and when the constitution was changed to multipartism, we started having these periodic waves of politically instigated violence. So in 1990, from 1991-92, we had politically related violence during the elections of 1992. And in 97, we also had politically instigated violence. And in 2002, because the President Moi was not eligible for re-election, and he was more or less retiring, there was no violence. Then come 2007, we had recurrence of violence again during the elections. In all this politically instigated violence, we never had any form of accountability. Killings would take place, mass displacement of thousands of people would take place, and there had never been accountability. We had one commission of inquiry that had been commissioned to inquire into the violence. It did compile its report. The report was shelved, and the recommendations were never implemented. And it had to take one victim to move court for the report to be publicized. But it ended at the publication, and the individuals identified and implicated as having triggered the violence or financed the violence were senior leaders in political parties, in government, and others were civil servants. Now, come 2007, after the commission investigating the post-election violence was created and after it did its job, more leaders were identified again. And the recommendation of the CPEV or the WAKI commission was that further investigation should be done. The WAKI commission was persuaded that crimes that fall within the jurisdiction of the International Criminal Court had taken place, and that a special tribunal was their considered opinion, a special tribunal that would inquire and bring to account the perpetrators. Now, immediately after this recommendation was made, there was a calendar which the government was supposed to react to by enacting enabling legislation for creation of a special tribunal. Three attempts failed, and which was deliberate because some of the suspects happened to have been in government. And after these occurred, the information was accordingly handed over to the International Criminal Court. The International Criminal Court in itself, through the Office of the Prosecutor, engaged in dialogue with the government of Kenya, giving government further time to try and create a national, local mechanism that could address this. But that was not to happen, and that prompted the prosecutor of the International Criminal Court to invoke his powers under Article 15, the proprio motu powers, for the very first time with regards to the situation in Kenya. He sought leave of the court and he was allowed to start his investigation. The temporal jurisdiction granted by the pretrial chamber relates to the period of June 2005 to November 2009. In however, as much as he was allowed to investigate post-election violence, he was equally allowed to consider allegations of extrajudicial killings and enforced disappearances, and a situation in one of the districts in Kenya, Mount Elgon district, where the military had been alleged to have been involved with the systematic torture of the civilian population. So the prosecutor, in his discretion, has decided to narrow down and conduct investigation limited to the post-election violence, and in particular, he has narrowed down to identifying six individuals in two cases. Now, in December of last year, the prosecutor applied to the court for unsealed summons to appear, and thereafter made public names of individuals whom he had sought summons against. the pretrial chamber is expected to render a decision as to whether the summons should issue, and we are still waiting for that. Now, in addition to this, following the refusal of Kenya to set up a local mechanism or a special tribunal, the prosecutor did proceed only in relation to those that bear the greatest responsibility, to the exclusion of thousands of crimes that might fall within the jurisdiction of the court, and to the exclusion of access to justice to thousands of victims. So we, as the Kenyans for Peace, Truth and Justice, had all along been insisting that, you know, ever as much as the International Criminal Court is interested and is looking into the situation in Kenya, we still need a local mechanism that should act as an access to justice to the thousands of victims that are still in Kenya. Immediately after the after the prosecution made the application for summons, we saw a change in heart by the government. They now said they are going to create a local judicial mechanism that should substitute the International Criminal Court, and that could actually be viewed as a ploy to rescue the six from the jurisdiction of the court. Now, the kind of suggestions that have been made so far by the government include creation of a special division in the High Court, which would have powers that are similar to the jurisdiction of the International Criminal Court. They would create a trial chamber of three judges, a pretrial court of a single judge, a special prosecutor, and also they would create the office of, the office of the counsel for the defense for the defense of the suspects. A bill has accordingly been published. It is yet to be debated. And we have also seen ever since that time that government officials have openly gone out to campaign against the International Criminal Court, arguing that the current prosecution is an affront to the sovereignty of Kenya. And in that regard, they have triggered a motion in Parliament seeking to compel the government to withdraw from the Rome Statute. We have equally seen government officials moving from one city to another within the African continent, trying to persuade African governments to come in their support. And basically, that negates the commitment by the Kenyan government to cooperate with the International Criminal Court. Now, in relation to, I've just mentioned the special tribunal. Some of the deficiencies in the proposed special tribunal, one include the fact that, for example, the police were heavily implicated in the extrajudicial killings around the post-election violence period, and are still expected to be engaged in the particular investigation with regards to the special, with regards to the local mechanism proposed. In relation to prosecution, the suggestion is to, for an appointment of a prosecutor, the role of appointment of the prosecutor is on the president and in consultation with the prime minister. That in itself is wanting because as of today, the six suspects who have been adversely mentioned are arguing that whatever they did in relation to the two principals, that being the president and the prime minister. And they, in fact, arguing why is the president and the prime minister not adversely mentioned by the court? Or why are they, why isn't the prosecutor intending to charge the two? I think I will leave it at that. And maybe after we engage in further discussions, I can respond to queries around the International Criminal Court process in Kenya.
All right, I guess it's my turn. I'll talk about Kenya's Truth, Justice and Reconciliation process. If there's time, I can also talk about efforts at implementing Kenya's new constitution. If there's no time, we'll just keep it within the Truth, Justice and Reconciliation Commission. After the troubles the country had in 2007, leading to the mediation that Binaifa talked about, that was presided over by the African Union, and there was an identification of the country's problems or the things that needed to be done to bring back Kenya to normalcy, because the country had slided dangerously close to a state of civil war. One of the issues that was dealt with was ending the violence itself, which was tied obviously to the political settlement about power sharing. But a dimension of the agreement was an identification of long-term problems that were deemed to be drivers of the violence, that were supposed to be structural drivers of the violence. And these long-term problems included problems in relation to the ownership and access to the use of resources, principally land. Agreement was reached that there was a multi-dimensional set of agreements to deal with the long-term causes of the of violence and disaffection in Kenya, but one of them was a Truth, Justice and Reconciliation Commission. Even before the violence, when the Kibaki administration came in 2002 or 2003, it had commissioned a study in the country on whether the country needed a Truth and Reconciliation Commission. And the study, after taking opinion from the public, reported that such a commission was needed, but no further action was taken at that point. But this question was revisited in the context of the violence in 2007, and agreement was reached at the mediation that a Truth and Reconciliation Commission be appointed. The parameters for the Truth and Reconciliation Commission were negotiated. There was involvement, it's got to be said, of a number of stakeholders, including ourselves, in determining some the parameters. Although later on there was an extent of capture of the process when the legislation that would put in place the TGRC was in its final stages. As agreed on, eventually, the country set up a Truth, Justice and Reconciliation Commission that has a membership of Kenyans and also the participation of a number of foreigners. The idea about foreigners being involved in Kenya's national processes, it started with the commissions of inquiry, one of which I was involved with, and it's got to do with the huge amount of mistrust that Kenyans have developed against one another, I guess in the context of our own conflict. So the involvement of foreigners in our TGRC process speaks, I think, to that stance. The TGRC was established to inquire into past human rights abuses, and also into political assassinations, which have been a hallmark of Kenya's politics, and also high-level corruption, grand corruption, which again has been a feature of Kenya's politics. It was given a temporal jurisdiction of the period since Kenya gained independence from the British, 1963 to the present. There was huge public discussion as to whether or not that jurisdiction was adequate. It being felt that the activities of the colonial state, which were no less abusive of rights than those of the independent state, could and should be looked into. The commission was given a mandate of 2 years within which to look into its mandate, and it required to produce a report that would be tabled before the National Assembly and also to the President for action. The appointment process for the persons who are going to be commissioners in the Truth, Justice and Reconciliation Commission was the responsibility partly of the government, but also partly of independent actors, including civil society like ourselves. I don't think the appointment process in hindsight was handled well. There was significant hurry in the selection of individuals, in selection interview and recruitment of individuals, and it resulted in the commissioners as selected do not have enjoyed a significant amount of public confidence. In particular, the chair of the commission, who was selected, has been the source of very significant misgivings on the part of people who have engaged with the commission. It is claimed, with some justification, that the chair, who in a past engagement, was a permanent secretary, a senior government official, working for a minister who was then assassinated, and the chair of that chair has, in previous inquiries over that assassination, which remains unresolved, been a witness 3 times. So, in all likelihood, he is going to be a witness yet again if that particular assassination is also dealt with by the TJRC, because it falls within its mandate. There have been attempts to get him to resign, but he has held on, and that has denuded the TJRC of its authority. It's been a single source of problems for the TJRC's operations in Kenya. The TJRC can recommend reparations. It can also, in terms of its legislation, recommend removal. It can recommend prosecution. It can also recommend lustrations. It can also recommend the pardoning of persons. It needs to be said that the pardoning of persons from criminal responsibility is not something that it's an issue that is within the control of the President and the Attorney General. So this recommendation can have difficulty if it is not. Acted upon by those whose responsibility it is to exercise the prerogatives of mercy. So that is the TJRC process in Kenya. As I speak, there's a sense of paralysis around the TJRC because it started with a huge amount of promise. It was reviewed and regarded as one of the pillars for resolving the long-term issues of the country. But as a result of the impasse surrounding the situation of the chair, who refuses to vacate office notwithstanding strong pressure that he should, then the process is not able to move forward in a way that can be regarded as credible. The last time is that as mandated by the legislation that establishes the TJRC, a commission of inquiry, a tribunal to inquire into the suitability of the chair was appointed, and that tribunal is given a mandate of 6 months. There has already been 1 year of bickering around the chair's position, which means that 1.5 years out of the 2 years will be spent resolving the chair, and the commission is only maybe going to be able to work with the chair's issues resolved for a period of 6 months. So consideration of all that just means that I don't think the country is doing well. I think one suspects that political support for the TJRC is not that forthcoming, and that the political leadership has sort of promoted the chair in staying put and withstanding the pressure that has been exerted on him to resign from external forces. It is the government's way of trying to ensure that nothing comes out of the promise that was made by the TGRC. I see that there is no time for me to discuss the constitutional reform process. Maybe it can arise.
Can George touch on the African Union, the reaction by Kenya now at the African Union to forestall the transitional justice effort?
Okay. Kenya is a member of, is a leading member of the African Union, contiguous with the Ethiopia, where the headquarters of the African Union is situated. Our engagement with the African Union in relation to our own the country's involvement with the ICC, we think, is motivated by an attempt to ensure that it strengthens Sudan's resistance of the ICC process, so that then Sudan becomes a firewall to protect Kenya against the ICC in the event, which is what is happening just now, in the event that the ICC takes jurisdiction in relation to Kenya. It wasn't clear at the beginning whether the ICC whether or not the ICC would start an investigation in Kenya, but the political leadership chose. There were two choices at the end of the commission of inquiry. The first choice was a local justice mechanism or the ICC. The political leadership chose the ICC, but explained that we choose the ICC because we know nothing will come of it. If the ICC comes to Kenya, it will be after 90 years and we'll all be dead. So, contrary to expectations, the ICC has acted relatively fast and is acting on Kenya during the lifetime of all the politicians who chose the ICC over a local justice mechanism. But as Kenya's situation was unfolding, the Sudan was referred to the ICC by the UN Security Council, and Kenya's continental diplomacy has been about strengthening Bashir's and Sudan's resistance to the ICC process. And as I've said, the calculation on the part of Kenya is, if Sudan remains unresolved, then it is unlikely that Kenya's situation will be addressed on a clean slate by the ICC. So it's a piling up of issues and trying to overwhelm the ICC and trying to vilify the ICC using the platform of the African Union. As part of that, what has happened in the recent past is that because there's a summit of the African Union coming up next week, the Vice President of Kenya and others within the Kenyan administration have, as some have said, have been visiting African capitals, trying to drum up support for a mass withdrawal by African countries from the ICC, and the mass withdrawal to be justified on the argument that the ICC is anti-Africa, well, maybe anti-Kenya this time round. So Kenya's problems should have a reaction from countries that are not necessarily part of those problems immediately. So we've had some responses to what is happening in Kenya. One of those responses is our presence in the United States here, where we are speaking to people like yourselves who can, through the academic environment that you come under, can perhaps take a disinterested restudy into whether or not those accusations by the ICC, or rather by Africa against the ICC, are actually justified, and also meeting officials in the government of the United States and seeking their support for an accountable resolution of Africa's very, very difficult issues in relation to the ICC. I think that is. What else did you want me to say? All right, so that I think should sort of cover that. Thank you very much.
So I think, you know, it's interesting because on many fronts, I think Kenya offers an interesting study for transitional justice issues. The first is that there's been a lot of truth-telling in Kenya in the sense that perpetrators of violence and perpetrators of corruption, etc., are actually named and known, not just named informally, but have even been named in government reports, have been named in NGO reports. So, for instance, unlike the Truth and Reconciliation Commission in South Africa, where information was being unearthed through that process, actually a lot of those debates that would come out in a Truth and Reconciliation process have already been undertaken. So our issue is not so much the truth-telling in terms of exposure of violations, but the issue really of accountability. So for us, the issue has been the fact that facts are known about violators, but in fact nothing's ever done at the domestic level, which is why the ICC is such a critical factor in changing the history of Kenya and beginning to break that deadlock, that it's actually been a very critical piece of the transition period. And if the ICC can pull it off, could really have great implications for setting us on the right track. On the other hand, one could say, well, did the level of violence really reach the levels that should have got to the ICC? I mean, in terms of all the worst conflicts in the world, would you have picked Kenya to have entered? I think that's very debatable. Will the prosecutor reach the level of evidence required to prove crimes against humanity on the systematic and widespread kind of level that needs to be shown? It's unclear to me, and let's see what evidence Ocampo brings in. Coming in to save Kenya is great, but on the other hand, if the blowback is that we lose the whole African continent at the African Union level and there's a pullout and we actually lose ground, was it worth it in a broader political calculation by the ICC prosecutor to have selected Kenya after being accused of selectively choosing African conflicts again and again and again, and then going for Kenya when he hasn't touched Gaza or Sri Lanka or Colombia, etc., other very significant crises that would warrant attention by the ICC. So there's a lot of complexity in this debate, and where it will all play out, I think, is really unclear. I mean, there's no clear sense of where this will end, but it is an interesting moment in Kenya's history, and the ICC really does offer a critical moment. And it's even made more difficult. You know, in most places with transitional justice, you have the end of a conflict, and either you get victor's justice, as in, for instance, the ICTR, where you have prosecutions against the government, government and military officials that were responsible for the genocide, but not against the RPF, who are currently in power. Or you have maybe a token case, as in the Sierra Leone court, where you have one case against the CDF, which was aligned with the government, just to make, you know, the appearance. But here you have a coalition government. Both sides are in government currently. Both sides in government have an interest in protecting their people responsible for the violence. So you have a formula that's really unseen in any of the other international justice formulas, where we have not seen a situation where all the perpetrators are in power, all of them, and doing the best that they can to block this thing against, you know, against the forces both domestically, regionally, and internationally. And who's going to win, I think, remains to be seen. So I'll stop there. Let's do a round of questions, and then we'll let our panelists answer. If you could introduce yourself, and also if you have any Kenya background or interests that you've been involved in, just also say that.
Sure. My name is Chris, and I lived in Kenya for 6 months in 2009, from January through July. So it was right at the one-year anniversary of the violence. And I guess my concern is, or I guess how much concern should there be about the 2012 elections in terms of avoiding the same sort of cycle that you talked about, another wave of violence?
Any other questions? Okay, we'll go there and there.
My name is Laura. I'm a senior research associate with the Public International Policy Group. I'm the head of the Kenya project for PLPG. Lots of interest in Kenya. I wanted to go back to the special tribunal and sort of, you know, the idea that it's being used to protect the six people who've been summoned to the ICC, and what the perspective is of civil society there, and sort of how, if at all, it can be pushed in the right direction so that there is a domestic response, given that the perpetrators are in power, if the ICC withdrawal actually happens, given that Parliament passed the bill. Just talk about that a little bit more, I think.
I Eileen Thompson. I'm a research associate with Public International Policy Group for doing some work on the Kenya project. So you'd mentioned some of the constitutional implementation issues, and I was wondering what you see as the relationship between, especially with the judicial reform and legal reform issues in the constitutional implementation, and what you see the connection with that and providing accountability for past abuses and maybe possibly preventing future issues in the 2010-2012 elections.
Anyone else?
Yeah. My name is Carolina Mello. I'm an international scholar here, and I'm doing my PhD on the right to truth, and specifically my interest not only on the Kenyan case, but I think also that the Kenyan case offers many things to think about. And one of the things is exactly the point that you raised, Rose. Now it's a lot of truth and not a lot of justice. And my question would be, how would the Waukee report in place in the now at the commission and the truth commission, and how would the both of them would help the ICC? I mean, how would this truth travel around between the two commissions and, or even more commissions, as I don't know, and the ICC?
Good. So let's take that first round. We'll start with George, and then move to Sam.
How much concern is there for violence in the year 2012? There naturally would be a lot of concern about violence, especially from the perspective that societies that have had large-scale violence, I think studies show that those societies can relapse into violence within a period of 5 to 10 years. So unfortunately, Kenya is a society that has faced violence, so the possibility of violence coming back is that much higher because of that statistical reality. Are there any lessons learned? And I think that's part of what you're asking. Is there anything, are we better prepared as a country for the violence? The sense is that if you talk to ordinary people, and that is also chilling, they tell you this time round we will not be caught unawares. We will be ready if violence should come. Because there's a sense in which a lot of people who are the victims of that violence, it's caught them completely unawares. But if you've got the arming of civilians taking up arms, illegal arms, crude arms in preparation for what could be a violent period, then it's not a nice thing. You've got to then have an enlightened law enforcement, but also an enlightened program of keeping the country together, notwithstanding the politics. That, I think, is not necessarily in evidence at the moment, unfortunately. What you have instead is there's a rousing of passions around the ICC. There's the creation of new political alliances. What I think will be crucial is when the country gets to a home stretch and political alliances have solidified for the next elections, what will be the messaging, the specific messaging for those elections by the politicians or by those who will be trying to win those elections? If the messaging is or promotes violence, the country can have violence again. If the messaging steers clear of the violence, hopefully then the country can have stability. Have the politicians, are they shy of promoting violence because of what has happened in relation to the ICC? I think there's more awareness about the possible consequences of openly promoting violence and that one could be held accountable. So the expectation is that unless people are promoting violence, that will not end. So that accountability against them can then be established, they will be more circumspect about openly promoting violence. I don't know whether that answer is satisfactory or even correct, but those are my views. The next question is the Special Tribunal for Kenya and the Constitutional Implementation for Judicial Reforms. I think there's the government is is fudging very much around what it needs to be doing in relation to the ICC, the Special Tribunal, and judicial reforms. Judicial reforms, as mandated under the new constitution, constitute a process of wholesale vetting of all judges and magistrates that are serving at the time the constitution came into being. The process for that vetting is at an advanced stage of discussion, and has so far not been agreed on. Once agreed on, hopefully we'll start implementing it. We will also be required to create a new court, a new tier of the judiciary, the Supreme Court, again as mandated by the new constitution, and appoint a new Chief Justice and the Deputy Chief Justice. So the reforms in the judiciary are in contemplation and have not started. The judiciary couldn't logically and in good faith be seen for the time being as capable of playing a role in offering in the Kenya's justice justice needs in relation to the post-election violence. So the judiciary is in a state of flux. It would need, the reforms would need to take place, and having taken place, the judiciary would need to be settled if it can be regarded as capable of playing a role in supplying the justice needs for the country. What is being said, and that is why I'm saying the political leadership fudges a great deal around that, is that we have got a new constitution, we're going to soon have a new judiciary, as evidenced by a new Chief Justice who comes in February. So we will use our judiciary to undertake, we will actually have a special tribunal that is set up using this judiciary that is itself the subject of the reforms that I've outlined. Then if we have that STK, then we will be able to challenge admissibility of Kenya's case before the ICC. So I view these as a set of arguments that are blurring the issues deliberately, because Kenya does not necessarily promote accountability or want accountability. The right to truth.
And the sharing of evidence from the different commissions.
Yes. I don't know. It's a difficult question to answer. Let me say that. Let's talk about the relationship between, say, the Waki Commission that's formed and finished, and say the Truth, Justice, and Reconciliation Commission. One of the terms of reference for the Waki Commission was that it could make recommendations for the Truth, Justice, and Reconciliation Commission if and when established. Whereas there was no specific set of recommendations to the TJRC from the Waki Commission, its findings or its discussion of the issues can form a basis for the work of the TJRC if it was able to overcome its own internal challenges. So there's a linkage, at least in the appointment process, a linkage was established at that level. The work of the Waki Commission has, of course, also formed the basis of one of the many bases of the work of the ICC in Kenya, because the ICC was not restricted to that report. It also has considered independent reports by NGOs and the report of the National Commission on Human Rights, and there are other reports on the National Commission on Human Rights and other reports on NGOs by NGOs that also speak to some of the issues. So the challenge in Kenya is, as you said yourself, is not a lack of abundance of truth. There is an abundance of truth around. It is what is to be done with that truth. For example, to achieve reparations, for example, to achieve recognition for victims, and for example, to achieve accountability against persons that the truth ordains should be the subject of some accountability mechanism.
Okay, I'll not touch what I think George has captured. Just to discuss about the first question that was raised in terms of prospects of violence in 2012. One main problem in Kenya is impunity. Now, our politicians and the manner in which they have engaged in politics include violence. Some of the systematic violence has resulted in displacement of voters deliberately. Now, this kind of politics, if it is not contained, it is possible to occur again, because we are dealing with the more or less the same similar political players. And if it is convenient for them to engage in such kind of politics, if they believe that a certain segment of society will not vote for them, then they are better off displacing that segment of society not to vote. So maybe I'll just leave it at that. Now, going back to a special tribunal, the proposals we have at the moment, the bill that has been published is not a bill for a special tribunal. The recommendations in the Waki Commission were for the creation of a special tribunal that would have international components in terms of the members of that tribunal, in terms of capacity. At the moment, the proposal is for creation of a special division. It's more or less very similar to what happened in Uganda. They created a special division in the High Court. Now, I think issues that I can flag in the current proposal for a local judicial mechanism, which is a special division of the High Court, one is there is very limited participation or consultation. In fact, today I was looking at the draft bill and I was asking myself, how fast, it's a private member's bill, it looks quite exhaustive with a lot of information, and I was even wondering how fast this private member could manage to produce this bill, who was consulted, because civil society has not been consulted on the same. So there is the question of participation and consultation. Then the timing of it and sequencing. Because in however as much as we might have issues around the form and the proposals as they are, the proposal to create a special division of the High Court, the local mechanisms as proposed, should not act as a replacement or an alternative to the International Criminal Court process. And in essence, the political leaders are arguing that once we put this in place, then we shall have a basis of getting the ICC off our backs. Judicial reform that should act as a ventilation to 2012, all these reform processes are intertwined. For example, we have security sector reform. As in, judicial reform by itself cannot act as a ventilation to violence in 2012. It has to be linked very closely to electoral reforms, to security sector reforms and other reforms. I think George had captured that with the spread of the truth between all these three organs.
I think it's interesting to watch, you know, how have gains even been made? How have we even actually made such gains? And, you know, in a sort of coalition of impunity, a government coalition of impunity, and it's because they try to play off each of the justice mechanisms against each other. So, for instance, there was no political support to form a Truth and Reconciliation Commission until they thought the ICC was coming, and they hurriedly formed it and put it into place. That didn't seem to work. Then, and at first they thought, let the ICC come, please come on in, we won't have to then do a special tribunal because, you know, the ICC is not going to do anything if they haven't got a single conviction yet. Let's just invite the ICC in and we'll play this game. And so the first set of meetings of the ICC were all very pally-pally because they really didn't think anything was going to come of it. It's only when the issue of, you know, the summons and the announcement that things were moving forward, they essentially ran to the African Union to block the ICC and to withdraw from the Rome Statute and now to repeal the domestication of the Rome Statute in Kenyan law. The special tribunal, the domestic tribunal, they voted against it three times in a row before the ICC came in, thinking that this would be a way to block accountability domestically. But now that they've realized that a domestic remedy might block the ICC, they're moving forward to try and push. So the benefits that have been gained for justice have really been gained by political calculations on their part on how to avoid justice. And so each has made gains at the expense of the other, and how which one will prevail in the end and how it will again pan out is, you know, you'll have to watch the space. But it's really a fascinating period in Kenya's history.
There was also the discussion about giving the jurisdiction to the Truth, Justice and Reconciliation Commission to try post-election violence cases as also a way of fending off the ICC. At some point, one of the varieties they discussed was that.
And while you're doing all that in the political arena at the forefront, you do other things as well. You bribe possible witnesses for the ICC, you kill possible witnesses before the ICC, you block. I mean, there's a lot of things happening behind the scenes that are going on to forestall justice as well. So there's the whole, I mean, it's an intricate chess game that's being played on many levels.
I'm sorry to interrupt the fascinating discussion. Let me just give you a round of applause. Help me thank you.